So have you had any time or space during quarantine to take on any kind of hobby or anything?
Well, I've been biking as much as I can get out, and I will tell you, I'm sacrificing biking time right now to do this interview, and it is an absolutely glorious spring day here in Atlanta.
I really appreciate you making the time.
Yeah, so I just want you to know.
Welcome back to the Broken Middle Podcast. I'm your host, Pastor Kurt Poland, and this is a podcast where people trying to make a difference in the world of faith, art, and politics make a good faith effort to understand each other. Today's guest is Dr. L. Edward Phillips, Professor of Historical Theology and Christian Worship at Candler School of Theology of Emory University. Dr. Phillips is interested in worship, specifically the rituals that you and I enact Sunday after Sunday. Where do they come from? What do they do? And why do they look so different from church to church? In his new book, The Purpose, Pattern, and Character of Worship, Dr. Phillips seeks to address this question. He identifies six dominant patterns of worship in the United States today: the revival model, which looks like the modern seeker service; the Sunday school model, which looks like modern creative worship; the aesthetic model, which looks like modern traditional worship; the Pentecostal model, which is what looks like modern praise and worship music; the prayer meeting model, which we know in terms of modern cell groups and small groups; and the word and table model, which is the dominant form in most denominational books of worship. Each one of these patterns of worship has its own goal and its own character. In this first part of the podcast, Dr. Phillips and I will talk about the first three patterns: the revival model, the Sunday school model, and the aesthetic model. We'll get into the final three patterns in the next episode. Dr. Ed Phillips, welcome to the Broken Middle Podcast.
Thank you so much, Kurt. It's great to be with you.
Let's jump into your most recent work, Patterns, Purpose, and Character of Worship. In your book, you identify six dominant patterns that contemporary public worship takes in the United States. And I'm sure that listeners who have some experience with church will hear their own worship experience described in one of these patterns. So can you begin by just laying out the six patterns, and then we'll try to dive into each one of them for a little bit and expound them further?
Sure. So the origin of my work on this actually developed out of my work with congregations and talking with congregations about how to renew their worship, how to revise their worship, how to start a new worship service, and so forth. And as I listened to people talking, what I realized, often conversations would be something like this. Someone would say, well, it's very, very important that we always say the Lord's Prayer. And then someone else would say, but do we have to use that old-fashioned language? And someone else would say, but you know, if we have a printed prayer, it's just not going to speak from the heart. And someone else would say, you know, something like, yes, and that printed prayer, it just gets in the way. Or they would say, well, let's just revise it. Let's just write our own prayer instead of the Lord's Prayer. That you know, that goes back to Jesus 2,000 years. It's due for an update. And what I realized was that these different people were coming at the problem with very, very different expectations and different goals. I sort of use this analogy of saying it was kind of like having a meeting to talk about sports, and one person wants to talk about soccer, and one person wants to talk about baseball, and one person wants to talk about basketball, and so forth. And they're all sports, and they all sound like the sorts of things that would be fun to play, but they have different procedures, different goals, different, they might use the word goal, but it means something different in each game, and so forth.
We had an experience of this just recently where I was trying to introduce some of our older members to the idea of a service that would have a different form of music that the young people in our congregation are able to play. And one of my older members said, we're never going to have any of that jazz in church, because we know from experience that the traditional service will triumph. It will triumph. That's what he said. And that goes to exactly what you're describing. That's someone, I think,
that we're going to get into in a second, but it's coming from an experience of the aesthetic model, I would say.
Yes.
Please continue.
Anyway, so thank you. I mean, that's a great illustration of exactly my point. What sort of purpose does worship have? Now, I think generally everyone would agree that in a broad sense, worship is for the glorification of God. And to use a real churchy word, sanctification of humanity. In other words, bringing humanity into its full purpose before God. At the very least, sanctification would mean that. So I don't think in the broadest sense we would have a whole lot of debate about that. But how does that get accomplished in congregations in their public worship? So this is where it becomes interesting. I think that there are six primary models that have developed over the last 200 years in the United States. And these models briefly are the revival model, the Sunday school model, the aesthetic model, the Pentecostal model, the prayer meeting model, and then finally the Catholic renewal model. And I use Catholic probably in a very technical sense for the listeners to this podcast, but by that I mean the sort of universal history of the church. I think each of these six models developed in its form, many of them in the 19th century, others right at the beginning of the 20th century. And I think each one of these models has its current manifestation in our congregations today. So the revival eventually evolved into the seeker model church, the seeker church. The Sunday school evolved into the creative worship model. The aesthetic model is what most people refer to when they talk about traditional worship. The Pentecostal model evolved into the praise and worship model. And I will say a little bit more about that later, but the praise model, praise and worship model. The prayer meeting revolved into the house church model or the small group model for worship. And then the Catholic model, really we find this in many of our denominational worship books anyway, referred to as the word and table model, drawing on the resources that go back to the very earliest centuries of the church. Now, each one of these models has a specific goal that it aims to achieve. Just briefly, if I may, is this
Please,
appropriate?
Please, by all means. This is great.
So the revival model has as its goal conversion. Each goal, and I want to illustrate this with the revival model, each goal attracts a sort of character to it. You know, the kinds of activities that would be appropriate to move a congregation towards that goal in its worship. So the character of the revival is novelty and a heavy emphasis on technology, technique, and so forth. And this is what we see in the secret church today, where the goal is really to reach out to the great numbers of, in their language, unchurched people in order to introduce them to the very fundamentals of aspects of the gospel. You know, what's attractive about that? This is something the revival church model also really stresses, is you want to attract people. And I find this in the secret church today. The revival in its 19th century form culminated in an altar call. And not too many secret churches today will use an altar call, but the idea still is very much the same, to try to intrigue people with what's going on who absolutely do not know anything about church and might even have an aversion to traditional aspects of church. And so the idea still is to bring people into a rudimentary relationship to the church and to Christ. The Sunday school model.
Oh, can I ask a question about
please.
Model?
Please. Stop me anytime. It's your show.
So, I mean, that to me sounds very much like the kind of church that I grew up at, where the service begins with a band that has prepared a piece all week. That sounds great. It sets the tenor. The music that's sung is easy to participate in. And there's often an invitation to give your life to Christ at the end of the service. And I think that here in Southern California, a church that's emblematic of that would be Saddleback, mm-hmm. Rick Warren's church. And there is something really attractive about that, because it's a low buy-in when you go for a high production value. There's something sort of inviting and exciting about seeing the lights and the drums, you know, I would say in a more technology influenced a version of that. And I find that some of the young adults who come eventually and find our church are really familiar with that form, but have gotten tired of it and have gotten tired of the high production value aspect of that. And even though they don't regret the time that they spent in that model, the technology, the utilitarian aspect of it has kind of run its course and feels rinsed now, and they're wanting something a little bit deeper. So I'm sure we're going to get into that as we go.
That's a great insight. And I think that is the testimony of a number of people, especially given the fact that really the seeker model is for seekers. It's not, it didn't develop in order to push people towards mature Christianity. And in a sense, it, you know, sort of like comparing, you know, the first love, when you first fall in love with someone, and what it's like to live with someone for 5, 10, 20, or in my case, more than 40 years with my wife. Your love evolves, but it's not the same, you know, sort of experience as it is, you know, when you're, you know, just beginning to date or fall in love with each other. All that is to say is I think that the seeker model achieves some really amazing things and has taught the church a lot, especially about performance, that it really matters how we lead and conduct and pay attention to the effects that what are happening in our congregations will have on the people who attend and are worshiping. But yes, it does have its limitations. And actually, the seeker churches have been aware of this and not particularly troubled by it. They have other methods of worship typically for their long-term members to allow them to mature.
That's, I think, reflected even in the architecture of the church where I grew up. After I left and had a sort of a definitive walking out experience from sort of my evangelical background, which I think is sometimes a part of just the wider life experience of people who grew up really taking their faith seriously and then found themselves wanting more. When I look back at the church that raised me, Cherry Hills Community Church in Highlands Ranch, Colorado, they now have a beautiful chapel that they've built where they have services that don't attract nearly as many people, but that are more liturgical, that have responsive readings, and that aim for a strong aspect even of Christian education, which I think then leads us into what you were going to say next about the Sunday school model.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I mean, right. And I know from a lot of anecdotal evidence that many churches are doing this. I mean, it's not uncommon today to find churches that think of themselves as in the contemporary church mode, which includes seeker, but is wider than the seeker mode, that often those churches will in fact begin to bring back some things from the long Catholic tradition of the church, the seasons of the year, or the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist is a more frequent event in their life of their congregation and so forth. So that's not at all surprising to me. And it shouldn't really be surprising at all for a church that sees as its primary mission, if you will, to reach those who either know nothing about Christianity or who have been turned off by some aspects of the Christianity that they grew up with. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of respect for that and the great attention that's been given to that. But Sal, yeah, the second model is the Sunday school model, and it arose really the same time in the 19th century that the form of revival that we have now arose. And but it was a very different, had a very different goal to it. In the 18th century, no churches had Sunday schools. By the first 25 years of the 19th century, many, many, many Protestant congregations had Sunday schools. And it began to focus on the education of children broadly, but specifically the religious and civil education of children, civic education of children, to teach them how to be good citizens of this growing United States. Once it took off, it began to be part of the Protestant landscape, had a lot of effects on how we do church. I mean, if you can imagine, no churches had Sunday school buildings or even Sunday school rooms in a building at all. you know, by the end of the 19th century, every church just about would think about how we're going to house the Sunday school. So it added a lot of expense and pressure for pastors to do programming. But the Sunday school model is aimed at trying to educate people into the Christian life and, you know, to be good Christian citizens. And so it took an exercise approach to worship. You know, in the revival, the kind of the idea is we're really, in a sense, trying to get people theatrically, you know, so we want to move people in their guts, if you will. The Sunday school is aimed more at the head. How do we educate people? And so it began to refer to the various activities of worship as exercises in which children would practice. You know, if the model of the revival is more like the theater, you know, the model of the Sunday school is more like the gymnasium or the classroom. Now, the Sunday school began to bring back into Protestant churches, you know, sort of middle of the road and more evangelically oriented Protestant churches. It began to bring back into to them things that they had not really embraced, things like hymn books to be able to help children learn music, or bits of liturgical tradition from the long past of the church, the use of creeds or acclamations or doxologies, and, you know, recitation of Bible verses, the Ten Commandments and so forth as part of worship. But it's aimed more at the head. You know, you might say that the difference would be between, you know, trying to move somebody theatrically so that they're weeping at the end of the worship service. You know, the Sunday school is less concerned about that. It's not as concerned about getting that great speaker to come in and lead your congregation. It's really more, how do we help children learn how to be Christians? So let's teach, you know, this child how to recite John 3:16, and they'll stand up and recite it and stumble through it. And everybody thinks it's great because it's that child doing it for the first time. And right. Nobody worries about the technique, right? It's not meant to cast a spell. It's meant to involve that child in learning this new activity in his or her life.
Is this where all these children's songs to teach Christian values come from? I mean, I will make you fishers of men if you follow me. And
a good many of them do. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I just see my little brother went to Awana when we were growing up, and I feel like Awana is a quintessential Sunday school model program. So what does that look like for adults? Are there Sunday school patterns of worship that are being used by churches today? I mean, I might see in my mind's eye what they do over at the Loft in Westwood here in CalPAC that has kind of breakout groups, and the space is actually kind of an auditorium with circular tables where people will then break out and have discussions about what's right. been said together. Is that kind of in the Sunday school vein?
It probably is. I mean, it certainly incorporates aspects of the Sunday school, especially the notion that that education is the primary task, that we're teaching something. The character of this, of course, is, you know, didactic, more oriented towards exercise, less concerned about technique and more concerned about hands-on. It's sort of like, you know, how do you, you know, if you're playing basketball, you know, practicing your free throws or fast breaks and so forth. The idea is that we're just going to do it and have a real hands-on educational experience, and someone coaches us with, you know, how to do it better. But also, because educational techniques have changed, we tend to be a lot more oriented towards discussion today than we do towards catechism, you know, we just memorize the answers to questions or just merely memorize scripture. So, but that educational aspect is key. The current or the more recent version of Sunday school model is what I call the creative worship model. And this arose in the 1960s and really took off in the 1970s, in which the idea is that worship is resources that the pastor develops or the worship leaders develop and write in order to educate the congregation in the process. It tends to emphasize things like printed texts that people read, a script, you know, like you would in a Sunday school class, you know, if you're memorizing a scripture or everybody reciting something together. It tends to focus on the production of a lot of resources or drawing upon resources. I mean, there's a whole business that arose in the 19th century around producing liturgical resources for congregations. It's heavily print oriented, and in the creative worship model, one of the hallmarks would be something like the use of the exclamation point. So you write something in your church bulletin, you know, and you want to make sure the congregation really, really says it with enthusiasm. So you'll put one, two, or three exclamation points after it. And it never works. The fact that it never works, you know, is kind of beside the point. But the idea is we're trying to, you know, educate people about what the worship is supposed to entail for them. It's very constructed. It can use very traditional materials, but the point is more towards construct. It also, in its creative worship model, emphasizes, again, novelty, not unlike the revival, but it's a novelty that's meant to provoke thought. Mm-hmm. So it's not meant to provoke an emotional, I want to give my heart to Jesus kind of reaction so much as, well, let me think about this. You know, you've made me say this confessional prayer. I'm not so sure I agree with it. I want to think about whether or not I need to be confessing that personally. But the idea of constructed written materials, this is part of that creative worship model. And there were a number of books and resources that actually had the word creative worship in the title that came out starting then. And we still see the emphasis on this in many of our congregations today.
I mean, when I was in my previous role as a children and family director, I was trying to start a messy church service. We just couldn't quite get it off the ground. But yeah, these prepackaged materials that are new to the people who do them. And can be wonderful, but I felt this pressure too, that I really wanted to write my own material, my own curriculum to try to keep it organic and fresh and not just have it be this boilerplate pre-produced, Sunday school industrial complex kind of thing, that felt more tailored to our environment. So what are the strengths and weaknesses of creative worship as you see them unfolding now in congregations?
Well, the strength, I think, is actually seen in the title itself. The idea of using creativity and applying that to worship is certainly something to be celebrated and encouraged. I think that the amount of thoughtfulness that it gives to worship leaders in trying to think about the prayers, the music that we bring to our congregations. And I think the creative worship model really works extremely well in situations like retreats or, you know, certain kinds of small group gatherings where you want to have stretch people's imagination, or you want to in particular kinds of ways, or you want to have people learn and study and think about what they're doing. So yeah, it's got its definite strengths. It has its liabilities. Among them is the liability of manipulation that I guess all worships or leadership has its as a liability. But with creative worship, it's especially it's one of the real vulnerabilities of this. So for example, I might push back at you as a pastor. Why do you think you have the authority to write out a prayer and put it into the mouths of your congregation?
It's a great question.
Yeah.
Because I guess the tradition tells me I can.
Well, recently, but not, it's a very recent sort of thing. It really only comes with the advent of local printing possibilities. Mm-hmm. Economic printing radically changed what we do with how we think about worship. I mean, we as churches in North America and really in other parts of the world for that matter.
You know, I hadn't thought about that quite, but it's the Sunday school model in particular and its effect and its ubiquity that has required churches to spend so much money on our big fancy color printers.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's that. We could do a whole different program on the effects of the local printing processes on congregations and the idea that you have to have bulletins and so forth. I think that's interesting because in fact, we're transitioning into a new model in which rarely do churches today feel compelled to have a worship bulletin in the same way.
Interesting. Yeah. In fact, it was a bit of an adjustment when I came to Santa Monica from a congregation, Central United Methodist Church over in West Atlanta, who didn't use worship bulletins at all. It wasn't even a thing that anybody thought about. And I had to readjust to this In fact, I'd never been part of a church that had a printed worship bulletin. It was a new thing. Interesting. So there's the revival model that's become the modern secret service. There's the Sunday school model that's become the modern creative worship style and pattern and model. The next one is the...
Let's go aesthetic model.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So the aesthetic model developed in the late 19th century as congregations began to be more wealthy in parts of the United States. You know, on what used to be the frontier will eventually settle down into counties with county seat towns and attract doctors and lawyers. And sort of middle of the road Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, they wanted to make sure that they could attract those more cultured and wealthy, at least more wealthy people in their congregations, more educated usually. And they began to be worried that the Episcopalians were going to get all of the doctors and the lawyers because they tended to have churches that looked kind of churchy, you know, with darker interiors, with maybe stained glass and so forth, and investments. It just looked more high class, to be blunt. And so they began, Protestants in the middle began to emulate that model. And the literature that was published in Sunday school journals and pastors' journals has numerous comments about how we need to up the social class of our worship. This is very, very important for us if we're going to continue to be a dominant force in the American landscape. So churches began to make their worship sound more churchy and began to bring back churchy sounding language with things like choral introit and offertory. Now that may word not seem like a really churchy word, but you know, here's an amazing thing. In the 19th century until the latter part of the 19th century, the vast majority of Protestant churches did not regularly take up a money collection and call it an offertory in worship. It just, wow. They took up money in other places, in other ways. Pew rentals, for example, was one of the dominant ways that churches did this.
The emergence of the large pipe organ in American churches also.
Yeah, that's interesting. The pipe organ is an interesting example of having kind of two places it originates back into Protestant churches. One is through the revival, because the revival was like the big stage band instrument. I mean, you could do all kinds of things with an organ, and churches began to want to have these organs because you could have, you know, big crusade type choirs and sing along with it, and it could wow the congregation, and you wanted that wow factor, right? And then, of course, this is the way it always happens, is like large congregations will start something and then it will be copied by smaller congregations who want to be like the big church. It's the history of it in the last couple hundred years, certainly. But yeah, so that's one place it comes from. But then the use of classical music that fit better with organ than with, you know, a piano or even a cappella type singing really does come in through the aesthetic model. I mean, the idea was we're not going to just use it as a kind of a, you know, theatrical instrument here. We're going to use it more as an instrument that's more like the classical concert. And the idea of having classical pieces in mainline Protestants in the 19th century really is a direct result of this aesthetic model. That's what most people today think about when they talk about traditional worship.
Yes. Worship. So when did this model really hit its high point and really become what we all just assume and see in our mind's eye when we think about traditional worship?
Really in the mid 20th century is the apex of it. This is when a number of churches, it begins, first of all, as a large church movement when even Baptist churches began to emulate either Gothic style windows or maybe Romanesque style windows, things that look like the history of European art. And when I use the word aesthetic model, I'm, you know, it, I want to be clear. I'm not speaking about aesthetics, particularly about the concept of beauty and so forth, you know, categorically. I'm talking about a particular form of worship that idealizes European forms of art as a way of raising the sort of social class appearance of worship. There is an implicit classism built into this. You know, the idea that somehow there is an upper class aesthetic that we need to, meaning we Christians need to emulate if we want to be upper class people. We want to be, so it has social status implications built into it. And we're not talking about, you know, beauty that comes from Africa or beauty that comes from Asia, unless it's played through a kind of European model first.
Interesting. Yeah. So what is the purpose of the aesthetic model that then leads to its character?
Yeah. So the aesthetic model starts moving churches towards the question of, well, if revivalism is, you know, theatrical, and maybe even, you know, sort of like P.T. Barnum in a way, you know, trying to that side of theatrical, and if Sunday school is all about exercises and you know, mostly, you know, forming children. That, by the way, one of the reasons that Sunday school becomes a important model is because these children grow up, right? And these are the habits that they bring with them as they become adults and have their own children. So it's not surprising that there would be this use of exercise-y types of, you know, worship exercises in worship that adults would want to have. But what it seemed was just kind of arbitrary. It didn't have the historic depth to it. You know, the question you started when you talked about seeker people in seeker churches, you know, finally wanting something that has deep roots to it, you know, that really goes back beyond just a group of people singing, you know, some praise chorus here in a congregation. So there's this move towards the trying to find the real core of worship. Mm-hmm. This is the more intellectual and philosophical approach to the question: what is real about worship? Are we, when we're praying prayers, is there, and we're structuring our worship services, is there something about that that unites us to something transcendent and true beyond our local congregation? You know, how are we part of the big picture, you might say, is a simple way of putting it. What is it that's beyond me and my own imagination? Mm-hmm. So the idea was, let's try to find something that is real. And what this, the aesthetic leaders in the early 20th century, around the year 1920 to 1930, what they began to say was, well, this may be counterintuitive, but what they said was this: there is something genuinely true and transcendent in beauty and art. This is what the Protestant church has lacked, is a profound sense of beauty. Right. So let's have awe-inspiring sanctuaries. Let's get rid of this humble little communion table and make it into a big, massive altar that when people come into the congregation, they will immediately know this is significant, because this is what we see in those cathedrals in Europe. And you know, when you go into one of those buildings, it just immediately, intuitively inspires awe. So the idea was that beauty itself is a transcendent category that is real beyond just human construct. You know, it represents something that is fundamentally real. And so worship needed to be beauty. And a lot of books were written, you know, around worship as reality, worship as art. You know, essays were written about this, and it appeared in a number of church publications and in various curricula for divinity school students.
Wow. And so enter the big sanctuary, enter maybe even that era, that kind of Harry Emerson Fosdick era of the sort of the grand sermon with the pipes and Bach and the purpose of sort of almost like aesthetic ascent. Let's lift our sensibilities. Let's I feel almost there's even some enlightenment kind of values in that too. Am I off base on that one?
No, I think you're right. Well, enlightenment or just sort of post-enlightenment, I think certainly there is some influence of Kantian understandings of aesthetics. I mean, how aesthetic, the idea that there is the sublime that is more than just merely our sense of what's pretty or what's attractive or matters of taste, and that sense that sublime, you know, sort of gives us a peek into what's genuinely transcendent, what's beyond the local. And anyway, that's a little more philosophical than I want to go into. The point is that the idea began to take root in congregations, and even small congregations began to emulate Gothic or, you know, other European models of churches, for communion tables become altars and affixed to a wall. I mean, some of the things Protestants, you know, used to have fights about, all of a sudden just were embracing because they were pretty and beautiful. But there is a deep classism in all of this and a kind of a Eurocentrism in the imagination part of this. Again, the problems, it's not that it focuses on beauty, it's the classism aspect of it that they just weren't aware of being a problem really in the early 20th century. But the idea of going to reality, that's an interesting thing for me. You know, what's real? How do we know when we're praying that our prayer is part of something bigger than just us here today?
Yes. So I have a question about this one specifically, because I'm going to go out on a limb and say that First German United Methodist Church has a worship service that is most dominantly informed by the aesthetic model. And as you've noted, with that comes a hazard, a potential hazard, a liability to make a certain sense of cultural superiority or culture or sort of a kind of class consciousness. One of the most important things that worship does, and sometimes even people will like that style of worship, not really because they have taste specifically in 17th century organ or harpsichord music, but simply because it's what the elite do, you know, and that's how you feel like you're a part of that class. And so I find myself really wondering what can we do if we have a service that's dominantly informed by the aesthetic model to mitigate and maybe even subvert those class tendencies that pursues that avenue of beauty toward and beauty as reality and seeks the genuine or I should say has the character of that genuine reach for what is real in worship. It's still in that aesthetic mode. What's something that we can do?
I think for all of these models, among other things, trying to help people see that there are different ways that people have imagined worship, and that and offer some possibilities for the imagination to think about it differently. By the way, let me just say something positive about the, since I tend to be real negative about the aesthetic tradition.
Sure.
Model. I understand. Yeah, because I mean, it has dominated so much. You know, the idea of sort of church is the place where all the good people go, you know, sort of approach the church on the corner. And that's where anyone who wants to be a respected member of the society goes there, and they have taste because they go to that really beautiful church. That sort of cultural model of Christianity goes really well with the aesthetic model. But I would think today we have a lot of questions around that. I mean, among other things, as I said, the classist assumptions that are sort of baked into it. That said, I think for some churches today, there's something that has become interestingly resistant about the aesthetic model as a kind of counter against overly casual approaches to worship. If you might think about the worship pendulum as something that swings all over the place, but, you know, it tends to go to an extreme and then gets pulled back to the center. The idea of sort of very, very casual approaches to God, you know, that we should not approach God cultivating a sense of awe or respect, or how we would, you know, be in the throne room in the temple in Jerusalem. That sort of notion that we, you know, that we approach the Holy of Holies. You know, that we want to think about things today, you know, on a more deeply personal level. And what you lose is that sense of transcendence. And that's what the aesthetic model was originally trying to recapture. And I think sometimes today churches that hold onto this strongly see this as a form of resistance against overly casual understandings of God, mm-hmm. that want to turn God into, you know, use that from that interesting movie Dogma, you know, the buddy Christ, you know, that Jesus right. is just your buddy, you know. We don't want to weird people out with all the, you know, the God on the mountain sort of stuff. We want, you know, God to be one who's just our pal, that, you know, that walks with us and talks with us and is friendly. So we've always had those kind of images in the church, and the pendulum swings, you know, a variety of different ways. So it becomes interesting to me as a form of resistance. But in its chief form, it's very expensive, not unlike the highly technological secret church services. Mm. And because it requires a high level of it takes a lot of money to have an organ in the church
and to pay a choir.
It takes a lot of money to pay staff to have an excellent choir, right? Mm-hmm. Or to have all the vestments and all of this. You know, it's a very expensive form of doing worship.
And but I can see too how of all the models, the aesthetic model is the one that swings in the wheelhouse of the fear of God, the you know, the whirlwind in Job, the fear of God in terms of like the awe and respect, you know, the thunder and lightning atop Mount Sinai. I mean, you mentioned the God of the mountain. I can see that there's when you pull all the stops of the organ, I'm sure there's an aspect of the revival service as well. But there is So how about maybe another kind of question on the aesthetic model, and then I'm excited to get to the next ones. There's a lot of I think appropriate talk about decolonizing worship today. Mm-hmm. Given the Eurocentrism of the aesthetic model, can the model itself survive the decolonization of worship?
I don't think in its current form it will survive. But I mean, I've been wrong about other things, so who knows? I do think that certainly today, the appearance of pretentiousness is generally a turnoff for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of what provoked the whole secret church movement, is the pretentious aspect of church. So we went from, you're wearing your Sunday best and put on your best manners, you know, to go to church, to, you know, come as you are to worship. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter how you come, how you're dressed, all that's kind of irrelevant. And so, you know, whether or not that's actually true, I mean, there's a long history in the Christian tradition of preparing for worship. I mean, why would we think that worship wouldn't be something that, you know, the gathering of the community, why that wouldn't be something that would take some preparation to be able to engage in it fully and to let it do to us what it should do to us, right? Or the idea that church should be absolutely kind of like McDonald's, you know, have it your way. Everybody who comes, you know, we want you to come. And in a sense, there is probably, a kind of a commercial capitalist notion here that, you know, we have a product we want to sell, so we want to make it as accessible as possible to people.
Right.
That's kind of where the pendulum is now. And probably that was needed. I mean, I think that critique probably is an important critique to listen to. But if it swung too far that way, then maybe the aesthetic model kind of acts as resistance against that, and we should pay attention to it.
What do you see as the future of this model done well?
I guess if I had hopes for the aesthetic, I've never asked that question before. So this is an interesting sort of a test for me. Honestly, I think that a lot of the negative aspects of the aesthetic model need to be exorcised, if you will, need to be removed and examined, at least examined carefully. The classist assumption, the kind of Eurocentrist aspect of the worship model, I think should just go. I mean, I'm not trying to rehabilitate those.
Sure.
So then I guess what I would hope would come out of this would be certainly a more diverse understanding of aesthetic and some, you know, question about how the deep tradition of the church is certainly not effect, or that it requires a whole lot of money. You know, that it really needs to be deeply tied with how much money needs to be used for the building of these massive organs and so forth. Although, having said that, I love the cathedrals, and organ music played well is just absolutely amazing. So it's not like I'm against aesthetics. Let's right. be clear about that.
Anything. I so mean, I, you know, now I have this question that I've never asked myself before, but I mean, the organ, I feel like is such an essential instrument in the aesthetic model. And I wonder if anybody's written anything about decolonizing the organ as an instrument and what that might look like or sound like.
Well, you know, I've heard my colleague Jimmy Abington play the organ in chapel here at Candler School of Theology. He's one of the great, leaders in the African-American church music here in North America. And he is amazing. And when he plays the organ, it really can do a lot of amazing things. So it's not, the problem is not the organ per se. I mean, musical instruments do cost money. I'm grateful. And I think all of that can contribute, you know, to positive cultural and even religious values. I think that's possible. I guess what I worry about is when the aesthetic model becomes oppressive for medium-sized and smaller congregations in that process of emulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so for example, you know, you can listen to, this is, I may have, you know, this example, but it's like you can listen to a Bach sonata played at the top level of performance, and it can be just compelling to listen to it. But if you listen to it at a sixth grade recital, it's probably not going to be as compelling. Yeah. And the responses will be, well, wasn't that great? Only 12 years old, you know?
And it's right. Like,
but it's a qualitatively different experience.
Yes.
So if smaller congregations are constantly trying to emulate what the big congregations do in sense of the big aesthetic projects that they can accomplish, I think that becomes oppressive for small congregations.
Yes.
You know, what's the beauty of your congregation and how can you celebrate that, commemorate that? And, you know, we all have examples of where it wasn't the awesome, you know, huge choir performing something, but some child singing some simple song, not at a high level of performance quality. And there was something transcendently beautiful about it.
That's all for part one of this interview with Dr. L. Edward Phillips. Stay tuned for the next episode, which will go live on the website tomorrow.